Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast here in our D.C. studios. We're joined by the publisher of The Bulwark, Sarah Longwell, executive editor of The Bulwark, Jonathan Last, and, well, I'm here every day, Charlie Sykes. So where should we start? You know, I actually had a tweet last week that was featured on Morning Joe, which was just sort of like, where do you actually start? And you run through all the news stories of one day, and I couldn't include it in one tweet. It just kept going on and on and on. You know, you talk about the whistleblower, you talk about the Syria fiasco, do you talk about Doral, do you talk about, I mean, one thing after another. Jonathan, you had a piece yesterday, which I thought was fascinating, a detail about the, you know, the president flip-flopping on Doral. You know, is there any pretense anymore that he does not have operational control of Trump, the Trump organization?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, because just leaving all of the emoluments thing aside, that whole, I was going to give it for free, and I was going to do this, and like, wait, what's the I if you are not running the company?
Right, and how would he know what the company was going to do? I mean, leave that aside, right? I mean, was that in the proposal? Can we see the project proposal, Mr. President? Right? But of course, there isn't a project proposal. There's no RFP that went out by the government to every resort within 50 miles of the Miami-Dade airport or anything like that. It was just the president wants this thing to happen at his resort. And so everybody's just, okay, we'll do it. And that isn't even the fifth worst
right.
thing to happen to him last week. This thing, which would have ended any other presidency, right? I mean, any other presidency, this, the Doral thing itself goes to impeachment.
Yeah, and we're not even going to get to the latest stories about Rudy Giuliani and his Ukrainian cronies and all of that, because that doesn't make the top 10. But, you know, I'm still struck by the fact that he caved in on this. I mean, this is a president who never likes to admit he's wrong, never likes to reverse course, and this is, like, really close to him. And I talked to David Fahrenthold about this yesterday. Why did Donald Trump back off on this? Because this was his sweet spot. Why not just wait it out?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what happens when Republicans decide they want to actually stand up and say something, which it's a little bit annoying because in the grand scheme of things, of all the things that Trump does, like, the Doral thing is terrible. It's impeachable in its own right, but it's also like the 10th most impeachable thing that he's done. And so why?
50th.
Yeah, right. So like, why can't Republicans find their voice collectively in the same way on a host of other issues that they did on Doral? I mean, clearly somebody went to him, not Mick Mulvaney, clearly, because Mick Mulvaney went on the Sunday shows to make sure that we all knew that Donald Trump is actually still in the hospitality business, not in the presidenting business.
And he's the smart guy.
Yeah. But I mean, clearly there were Republicans who threw back their heads and howled about this.
But who? I mean, Marco Rubio was completely okay with it. Rick Scott was completely okay with it.
This is a tough question for you to ask me because it means I would have to name some of the backbenchers who did come out against it. Because there were a number of people who did in the Washington Post story.
Rooney.
Who?
Right.
The Congressman Rooney from Florida, the guy who's retired.
Profiles and courage on the way out the door.
Yeah, but Rooney, the Rooney situation is sort of a little bit different because actually what he did was he just said he was open to impeachment.
Yeah.
And it was really over Ukraine. And then, amazingly, he's retiring a day later.
There's a pattern here.
You really can't say what you think if you plan to stay in office.
Don't go waving these guys off of this. They ought to be welcomed. I mean, even if it's too, there is no such thing as too late, right?
Are you saying that I think that it's too late?
No, you're sort of like, these guys, why this is like not even the 50th worst, all of which is true. But at the same time, I think the general posture should be welcome with open arms. Like if Doral is what it took.
I think that's important.
Then come on over. The water's warm.
I totally agree with that. And I'm not sure that I'm not sure that the Doral walkback wasn't a culmination of Syria impeachment.
Ukraine, Syria, and Doral. Well, I'll give you back Doral.
Yeah, that's right.
We're not going to change course on
now
Syria.
Now that I've got $1 billion worth of free advertising out of the controversy.
Was there a lawyer, though, at some point who said to him, not that the president really cares about the law or cares about the rule of law, but there seems to be like some missing piece there that somebody who he listens to said, this is really bad. Unlike everything else, you're not going to get away with this.
That's kind of my operating theory here, is that something happened in the background that we don't know about. But on the other hand, maybe not. I mean, because again, this is I wrote this after his UN press conference, which is now like 5 weeks ago, I guess, 6 weeks ago. The president seems unwell. And I'm I you know, there are a lot of people who say, oh, he's crazy. Well, I don't mean that. I just mean that if you had a 70-year-old parent whose Twitter feed looked like Donald Trump's Twitter feed, and who, when you spoke with them, they moved in stream of consciousness in and out of things, they started reaching for words, you would worry about your mom or your dad. This is just an objective truth, right? I mean, this is,
it is.
Everything about it looks like, I would want to make sure that mom has a checkup, right? And it could entirely be that he's just gone from one thing to another,
see,
right?
On the same,
I mean, it's
line,
a real cuck
though.
Move.
No, but... I mean, on the, it is a cuck move. Yeah, well, this is the thing: the number of people who have been saying, "Hey, how weak the president is," you know, the surrender presidency. But going back to this, that the sort of the fundamental reality is that if anyone was behaving like this, who was the CEO of a major publicly traded company, there would be action. The board of directors would be concerned. If he was not the CEO, nobody would think, let's hire him as the CEO. Nobody would add him to the board. Think of the number of jobs in America where this kind of conduct, this kind of behavior would result in your suspension or your firing. And yet we're at this moment now where we have a lower standard for the president of the United States than we do for, I don't know, a manager at a car dealership.
This is literally true, though, that the only position of authority in which this sort of behavior is not only countenanced, but like everybody goes to lengths to cover it up, is for the presidency. In the same way that the only job from which Donald Trump could get a top secret security clearance
would be
as president. Right. Donald Trump could not be hired by the FBI or hired by the CIA because he could never get a security clearance. The only way for him to do it was to get elected president.
And that's why he keeps, you know, to just use the board analogy, if they were all acting board members, you know, it would be a different story. Make sure, you know, these are not people who will stand up to him in terms of the people who actually have the ability and the, assuming we're talking 25th Amendment, the
or
ability
something.
To do anything.
Or even just the electorate. Okay, so going back to this other point that you just made about the open arms for people who come around, because, you know, let's talk about Pierre Delecto. Can we talk about Pierre Delecto?
Yes.
The certain is je ne sais quoi, no?
Yeah,
c'est moi.
I would have a lot of fun lurking on Twitter, but it never occurred to me to do it. Who lurks
really?
On?
I thought most people who are on Twitter, I believe, lurk on Twitter. I think the percentage of people who, maybe not most, but some very high percentage of people who are Twitter users are passive receivers and not active tweeters.
I see what you're saying. I was, I must admit, unreasonably gratified that he was following me, though.
He was following you?
Yes, and liked one of my tweets. He liked one of George Conway's tweets. The reason I know this is that George Conway actually took a screenshot of it. And the one that he liked, I was referring to, I quoted the president's tweet, you know, the tweet where he talked about his great genius, and I said, the madness of the orange god king.
And that's the one that Mitt Romney liked?
Pierre Delecto liked that.
Wow. Yeah.
But, you know, so Romney is having a moment. And it's pretty obvious. He gave a very strong speech on the floor of the Senate on Syria. He gave a remarkable interview to McKay Coppins, The Atlantic. He appears on Axios, where he lays out his anti-Trump agenda. And I have to just, there is a subset of progressive Twitter that is like, yeah, but what are you going to do about it? You know, and will reject any sort of Republicans who ever break with Trump. And I just think it is time we have to talk about this. You know, how are we going to treat the people who come around who may not have been outspoken until now? And I think we ought to establish the baseline that, yeah, we are going to have open arms, right?
Well,
because what's the alternative? We don't need your help. We don't want you. Shut up.
For a certain subset of the left, until Mitt Romney performs abortions himself while officiating a gay wedding and proposing the socialization of medicine, he will still be wrong. And I had some patience for this sort of stuff pre-Syria, but now I don't. Because like every hour that goes by that Donald Trump is president of the United States, there is a literal life and death thing and not in a metaphorical way, like, oh, well, climate change kills X number of people per day and the clock is like, there is a specific thing that is happening over in this place that you can point to where people are dying because of policy decisions being made by him, right? And I don't know. It seems to me that we've had a large number of grown-up Republicans who have said, I'm going to stay in the party. I'm going to work in the administration. I'm going to just sort of be where I can to do good, just even though he's a bad man and et cetera, et cetera. The number of them who have actually decided to stand up and try to do something when the chips were down, I think is just one person big. I think it's just Mitt Romney.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right? I mean, this is, am I wrong? Is there anybody else?
Jeff Flake and Corker before them, but they're
and
gone.
They're the cautionary tales, which That's is, right. Why should I become Jeff Flake? He's ineffectual and you commit political suicide. So you do understand, you know, so yeah, there's not a lot of profiles in Corker.
But let's talk about Mitt Romney again, because I think he's different from maybe the people that we're talking about who may have yet to come around. Because Mitt Romney has been an interesting figure in that he, you know, it seems like years and years, lifetimes ago, but it was actually in January of this year that he wrote that op-ed when he came into the Senate.
God, that was only January.
It was only January. How much life has flashed before your eyes? So he,
I wrote about that in the first edition of The Bulwark.
Is that right?
That's the first one.
That's right. Well, because we launched in January. Yeah. So he, you know, comes into the Senate and sort of drops this op-ed that is, I went back and read it over the weekend, and it is a devastating piece. I mean, he says that that Donald Trump falls short of every measure and is of bad character and is dividing us and is not showing us leadership in the world, and that character is sort of destiny. But what's interesting is then. So then I went and tried to find out what did he say about the Mueller report, because I couldn't remember. And he did say that he was sickened by what he read, but he also said that he was pleased that there wasn't enough to indict the president, that we should all be glad about that, and that we should get on with the business of the American people.
The business of this garbage country. Sorry. Mm-hmm. The business of the American people is my least favorite phrase in all of politics.
Right. But is this interesting that he sort of like comes in, drops this what is the equivalent of a neutron bomb? And what's interesting is at the time, if you remember, just because it was sort of fun to relive this, Ronna Romney McDaniel responded and called him out for doing it. A bunch of senators jumped on him. Rand Paul said he was a big government Mitt Romney. And even people like James Lankford were kind of repudiating it, saying this isn't helpful, this isn't useful, we've got to work with the president. So you're Mitt Romney who comes in and you try to make a statement about who you're going to be in Congress. I'm going to take a principled stand against this guy. And what happens? Not only do all of your colleagues and your family members dump on you, but there's not really a constituency except for like this dwindling number of never Trumpers who are like, yeah, Mitt Romney. Republicans tell him it's not helpful, it's not useful, even the good ones. Democrats say, oh, great, another Jeff Flake or Bob Corker who are just going to talk and talk and talk and not
do anything.
And so he, I think, learned a lesson there, the lonely lesson of the damned if you do, damned if you don't Republican critic of Donald Trump.
And this is an important point that I think the people who want Republicans to stand up understand what the calculation is right now, that you will lose all of the support from the Trump base and you're going to get no love whatsoever because you're going to get the usual, you know, Charlie Pierce's from Esquire snarking you on Twitter. Well, you're still a conservative, blah, 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 blah. So why do it? What is the incentive? What is the plus for you to do it? So if we keep this, the fire is going to keep coming from the Trump folks. Don't you dare get out of line. And if there's continues to be, fire from the left, where were you earlier? Well, then don't be disappointed if nobody stands up and joins Romney.
But this is why Mitt Romney is sort of the only person who could be in this position, because Mitt Romney, in a Barry Goldwater like sort of historical fashion, has an elder statesman role. He doesn't need to run again. He's got more money than God, and he's got an actual moral compass. He actually cares about the party, the country, about all of us doing what's right.
He'll be alone.
And he's from Utah, where he actually could win re-election.
But
the only state, right.
But that doesn't necessarily, I don't know how much it matters to him that he does.
Yeah. Let me read you this quote from him, from this McKay Coppins piece, which is really interesting. He says, my life is not defined in my own mind by political wins and losses, he said. You know, I had my career in business. I've got my family, my faith. That's kind of my life. And this is something I do to make a difference. So I don't attach the kind of, I don't know, psychic currency to it that people who've made politics their entire life. That really sort of summed it up. That there's a normal human being who's balanced and goes, yeah, this is something I'm doing, but I'm not going to give up everything just to keep this job. I mean, so I'm not a United States senator. My life is still pretty wonderful.
Yes.
Which makes him an outlier, right?
Where was that guy in 2012?
Yeah, I know.
Do you remember the RomneyBot 2012, RomneyBot 4.0? Like, we'd gone from, like, severely conservative to, like, as a presidential-level politician, he was so awkward and overly programmed and so wildly political. This version of Romney, yeah, the, hey, look, I could take it or leave it, Romney, was not there.
Well, you saw
the
move, the Mitt.
Yeah,
Mitt. That was good. That was a different thing. So I guess
that guy might have won elections. The guy who's in Mitt had run for president.
If you'd known him, I want to go back to that after a word from our sponsors. Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security. Maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. Simply Safe has won a ton of awards from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter, and prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. So Sarah, I guess the question is, he clearly is going to play a central role. I mean, he's going to be at the center of this. Everybody's going to be focusing on him. He's decided he's stepping up. This is his historic moment. He seems to understand that, you know, that this is, he feels kind of liberated. But is he going to be, will he have any influence? What role will he play? Because we know that there's a lot of Republicans who say privately the same sorts of things, but for the reasons that we've discussed endlessly, they've been reluctant to say anything. So as this unfolds, what role is he going to play? Will he be sort of the moral beacon? Will he be there to sort of jostle the consciences of others? Or is it going to be just him alone?
Yeah. So here's the dynamic we have to consider, right? So there's Mitt Romney over here, and then there's Mitch McConnell over here. And what is Mitch McConnell saying to these Republicans? He's saying, everybody better hang together or they're going to hang separately. If we impeach this guy, we are all going down. Jody Ernst is going to lose. Cory Gardner is going to lose. They're going to try to make Mitt Romney feel like he is responsible for the loss of all of these jobs and the political power that they covet so much. Okay, so that's the pressure. Mitt Romney, on the other hand, though, and this is the key thing. So if you've got people like Ben Sasse and Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins and Lamar Alexander, and deep down, they know what the right thing to do is. What Mitt Romney has the ability to do is to go there as a human being and look them in the eye and say, you know what the right thing to do is for this country. It is not worth the job to not stand up for it. Like, you have to do it in this moment. And can he go get 20 people? I don't know. I think that sort of depends on facts on the ground and how much more comes out. But can he go get 5 people? I think maybe he can. And I think that makes a difference politically as impeachment goes forward.
Yeah, I am bizarrely optimistic. It's not the right word. But you and I talked a little bit about this earlier today. I actually think the chances of them finding 20 senators is non-zero. It's maybe it's not good. Maybe it's not quite 1 in 10. Maybe it's 1 in 20. But so the hardest thing to do is get from 0 to 1, as Peter Thiel always says, right? So, okay, so you get to 1. Once you have 1, you've got a guy who has sort of planted a flag that people can rally around and can also, more importantly, act as a human shield, right? So Romney can be the guy that all of the always Trump types hate. And if they want to focus on primarying somebody to make an example out of him, they want to focus on, you know, hating him, let it be Romney. And then you have people who sort of filter in behind the phalanx, right? And it's very easy to see how you get to 5 or 6, right? It's not hard to see how you get to 10, right? I mean, just when you do a whip of this, if you're at 10, honestly, I frankly think that Mitch McConnell is much more laissez-faire about this than you think, Sarah. because A, you know, he has very little to hold over anybody's head. The being the majority leader of the Senate is not like being the Speaker of the House. But B, if you get to the possibility of 8, 9, or 10 defections, that then is a symptom of really, really bad polling in the environment, right? And so today, with 52% of the public in favor of impeachment and removal, yes, it is very, very difficult to see how you get to more than 5, 6, 7 seats. But if that number gets up to 58, 59, if it hits 60, which again, when you look at the crosstabs, does not require a massive Republican defection. Right now, there are a whole bunch of Democrats who are still not on board with impeachment and removal. And the percentage of independents on board with impeachment and removal is actually sub 50 right now. That number crosses over to 50, 52. The Democrats finish getting on board, and then you get another 5% of Republicans. Now you are actually just under 60%. At 60, 40, I think we can't actually understand what that world looks like. There are going to be so many more dynamics created by that, that you could see how you could get to the point where they realize we have to kill the king.
But that's the thing. In order to imagine a substantial number of Republicans voting against the president to actually remove him from office, the world has to be different. We are talking about a different fact situation, a different environment. And you know, yes, getting from 0 to 1 is crucial. I think getting from 1 to 2 is going to be the big one, because once you start to see any sort of movement there, I mean, who's going to be number two?
Who,
by the way, will be number two?
Lisa Murkowski.
Okay.
She voted against Kavanaugh.
That's a big deal. That's a big deal if she starts to move. I guess I'm really skeptical of this, because I think there's a certain inertia. And if, in fact, it is the way you describe, Sarah, where it is Mitch McConnell playing hardball practical politics versus Mitt Romney appealing to the better angels of your nature, like, we're screwed. I mean, no. But there are stories. Josh Krasauer had a piece in National Journal. We said there's all kind of red flag warnings for Senate Republicans. They're not raising a lot of money. A lot of them are deeply underwater. So that there might come a moment where the real politique decision, not the what is good and virtuous, what is constitutional decision, the real politique is we have to bail from this guy. We can't go along with him. And I think that's the scenario you're talking about, where you get to 60%, but also you'd have to get a bigger number of, you know, you have to have this, the movement of the Republican base in these swing states where the senators, because senators from, I don't know, Wyoming don't care what the numbers are in New York and
right.
California.
So, but listen, so you can see how so you're right that we have to get to a different world, but you can see what that world looks like. So in that world, what the polling looks like is you got to start putting pressure on the safe Trump seat Republicans to go along with getting rid of Trump, because the only way of salvaging an extra 3 or 4 seats that are otherwise going to flip is running behind Pence and not running with Trump at the top of the ticket, right? So all of a sudden you start getting polling on what it looks like in Colorado if Gardner is trying to make a run at Hickenlooper with Pence at the top of the ticket versus Trump at the top of the ticket, right? And you can, again, it requires flipping the optics on this, but as the numbers shift, and as of right now, they are in motion. I mean, that's the other thing. We don't have to imagine that, like, all of a sudden people start caring. People care. We are watching the trajectory happen right now. We see the delta on this. We just don't know how far it's going to go.
And the last week, you could just feel people going, can we put up with 5 more years of this? Really? That was and it was happening so fast.
Yeah, couldn't something different happen? Couldn't Cory Gardner look at his polling numbers, or Joni Ernst look at her polling numbers, where they're underwater in their states and they're in, they're in trouble? Couldn't they say, actually, voting for impeachment is better for me? Not, and actually less Joni Ernst, but more like a Cory Gardner. Could he vote for impeachment to save himself, actually? Because suddenly a whole bunch of the independent voters in his state say, okay, you're breaking. I'll stick with you.
Absolutely. No, impeachment could wind up being the Hail Mary pass for somebody like him.
See, I just think the dynamic we were talking about earlier, though, he loses his Republican base and the Democrats are still going to vote for a Democrat.
Yeah.
Have you ever met a liberal Democrat who's going to vote for a Republican who breaks with Trump? Where did that happen? Even Will Hurd almost lost for re-election. Carlos Cabello, who was, you know, courageously critical of Trump, was defeated for re-election.
Yeah, but that's because their districts were blueing up considerably, and that's where I think like a specifically a state like Colorado, where the kinds of Republicans you have are the kind of Republicans who would be like, ugh, on Trump. Like, they're the kind of reluctant Trump voters, and it's the Democrats they have are also pretty moderate.
Okay, but you know.
I mean, the Republicans will have to vote for him because it's a binary choice, right, Charlie?
Well, that's what I'm getting. That's what I'm getting to. Because every conversation that you have with rank and file Republicans will go, okay, yeah, that was pretty bad. It was embarrassed by, you know, Syria. The Doral thing was terrible. And then you'll say, well, what about this? And within 5 minutes, you get, yes, but those Democrats, Elizabeth Warren scares me, and they'll run through all of this. And this is part of the dynamic that the Republicans who have, you know, went with Trump because it was a binary choice, that's still their default setting. And as the Democrats continue to be Democrats, and by the way, here's this moment. Let's just think about this for a second, where you have Donald Trump melting down. And what are the Democrats doing? They're having a fight between Hillary Clinton and Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, it's like, this is why you people are...
I don't know how they've ever won an election. It is stunning to watch. They will snatch defeat from every jaw of victory. What? First of all, also, I mean, I don't want to like divert into this insane land of Tulsi Gabbard and Hillary Clinton. But two thoughts. One, why can't somebody get Hillary Clinton to sit just to stay in the back for a while?
Oh, you want the woman to sit down and be quiet?
Yeah,
and know her
that's right.
Okay.
You know what?
Is that how it is around here?
They've got plenty of other women that can talk about it. They have that luxury. They're not like us where there's more guys in Congress named Dan than there are women, you know. So they have the luxury of putting a couple who are actually hurting the party off to the side. But then Tulsi Gabbard, to me, is such a weird person. But the dynamic on social media around the Hillary Clinton-Tulsi Gabbard fight, like every Republican who is like the worst Trumper is like suddenly standing for her really hard. And I just can't.
For Tulsi.
Like who?
For Tulsi.
Yeah.
Like who?
I'm not going to name names. You name names. You like to name names. But a lot of conservatives out there are suddenly like, Tulsi, why is everybody being so mean to Tulsi? This is terrible. And I just like, where is the Republican Party that would find a Democratic candidate covering for Assad to be like the person that they want to go to bat for among the Dems?
I'm sorry, this is the Republican Party that has backed the guy who is all in for dictators.
I know, I just
of
like
course, this
I
is
keep,
why,
I
right?
keep losing the thread as, you know, because it wasn't that long ago that we were normal.
Did you love the way at the debate she
we
danced around
we
impeachment?
Normal.
Did you notice that at the debate?
Tulsi?
Yeah, when asked about impeachment, everybody else is, you know, all the other candidates are, I would impeach him myself with my bare hands. And she was like, I voted for the inquiry, but he won fair and square. And there are a lot of people who wanted to impeach him from the day he took office. And that's not right. Just like,
she's going to be a host on Fox News. You know that, right?
I think she's going to be vice president of the United States.
Yeah, what is the play? Can somebody tell me the play? You think
Trump, Tulsi, 2020.
I could see her running as a third party at the moment.
Pence is going to be like, I got dumped for a Hawaiian Democrat.
To be fair, there aren't that many people who want these jobs anymore. I mean, the reason that Mick Mulvaney is still the chief of staff, I think, is because they can't find another one.
Acting chief of
staff.
He's assistant manager.
He's the assistant to the regional manager. Yeah.
Yeah, and Mick Mulvaney's supposed to be the smart guy in the
He's
White
the
House.
Smart guy.
Yeah,
he's the smart guy.
He's very fiscally responsible.
Okay, I think before we diverted into the Tulsi thing, I was trying to throw water on the irrational exuberance about the removal of from office. But I did think it was interesting that Mitch McConnell wrote that op-ed piece that was so harshly critical. On the other hand, the play might be, look, we can rip him on this stuff that doesn't matter to us, but we still can be, you know, we're sort of covering ourselves. It's kind of the theory that the vote in the House of Representatives to condemn the Syria bailout was simply to provide cover for the sucking up that we're going to be doing for the rest of the year. Right.
So this has been your theory from the start.
It is.
Right. And I buy it, except that it assumes that everybody in the public has all of their opinions siloed by issue.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so I think it is a danger. If this is the game that the Republicans are playing, it is a very dangerous game for them.
Okay, that's a good point.
Because so you go criticizing Trump on matters of war and peace and life and death, and driving up his negative poll numbers and his disapproval numbers. And then you think you're going to be able to say, well, then once he's at like a net 22 in his job approval, then you'll be like, oh, no, but I'm not going to vote to impeach him. Like, how does that work? Right. I mean,
yeah, I really think that's right. I mean, you can you can say that they can make the strategic calculation, like, but then this gives them room to like stick with him on impeachment.
They're being too cute.
But it would be too cute, because the fact is, all of these stories right now about Republicans breaking with Trump because they're frustrated over Syria, they make a difference. And they play into to just like Trump's psychosis, right? Like, he goes on these weird Twitter tirades, and, you know, he desperately needs these Republicans to stick with him. And so, but he can't quite figure out how to do this. So, like, he attacks people.
Okay,
and
so
acts like a maniac.
So your point, and we're sort of going in a circular way, the how the world has to change for, you know, there'd be a dozen votes, 10 votes in the Senate to remove him. The world can change because of exactly what you described, is that as things get worse for him, the president's psychosis manifests itself in ways that will become worse and worse and worse. If, you know, if you are a Republican legislator sitting back and watching the president, what makes you think that he is going to fix these problems by next May or next April or next October, as opposed to more facts coming out and the president behaving in a more reckless, inane manner?
Let me give you one better. What can go right for him between now and next November?
What gets better for him?
And the answer is nothing. He's not going to pass any legislation.
Rudy Giuliani was on a humanitarian diplomatic mission and just there to help.
Things
can
only get worse.
Totally.
The environment's not going to get better, right? I mean, the economy's not going to get
better
than this.
Chinese will cave in on the trade war. And we surrender to China.
I think we've already started our surrender to China. Right. I mean, this is
I think this whole surrender weakness thing is a real threat to Trump, because, as you know, how much of Trumpism is simply, and I'm sorry, Sarah, but, you know, waving the biggest dick in the room. You know, we are manly, we are winning, whatever we do. And suddenly when you have these serial displays of weakness, it you know,
super beta.
Yeah, it does look a little beta.
Yeah, but that's why they do things like, you know, say that they've negotiated a ceasefire and they've reached a deal with China. I mean, they just lie. The wall's being built. It's just they just have to lie now that any of these things are happening. And I think I'll tell you the one thing that can go wrong for them. And I worry about this a lot, which is that Democrats can overreach. And
Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah. I mean, like, Democrats can make it's sort of like, this has been a while ago now, but at the hearing where Adam Schiff sort of reads the Ukraine letter, and he decides to just like ad lib weirdly and make it 10% worse than it was when it was already super bad. And so I think they have to assiduously maintain their professionalism, and then let him just unravel the way that he's doing.
Yeah, I was actually over the weekend was watching that AOC rally for Bernie in New York. And it was basically like, you know, screw centrism. We are socialists. We're not going to settle for anything other than socialism. This is what we want. It's like, okay, great. This is.
Did you see the battleground poll out of Minnesota this morning?
I did.
So in Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar is up 12 points on Trump. Joe Biden is up 10 points on Trump. And Elizabeth Warren is up 10 points on Trump. How Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren could both be about the same, and Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden both about the same. But this is, again, I believe that Elizabeth Warren is the lowest percentage play available on the board for the Democrats. On the other hand, even the general election poll numbers for Trump are so hideous right now that she is now running almost as well against him as Biden is.
Yeah, but if you gave somebody like, you know, and, you know, a bizarro Sarah Longwell $100 million to work on those numbers by attacking Elizabeth Warren, you know, I mean, I've seen how Democrats can have, lose these elections when you pound them on. Here's their job killing environmental plan. Here's their, you know, freedom killing, abolition of your private health insurance and the open borders and everything. So campaigns could matter, but you could be right. This could all be just in concrete. And you used a phrase over the weekend when you were on C-SPAN, Sarah, about the exhausted majority out there. I do think this all of the stuff that we're talking about, the cumulative effect is, can we take it anymore? And what would a second term look like? I thought Ben Parker had a great piece in The Bulwark where he said, you know, a second term of the president who feels absolutely unrestricted. Can you imagine what it would mean for the rule of law? Can you imagine what it would mean for the multiple decisions? Take Syria and multiply that by 10. All of those things, it is horrific. And there's a sort of sobering moment. You think things are bad now. And this is where I really break with Ben Shapiro on this issue, because he says, I'm going to support Trump because we've basically seen the worst. right? Isn't that basically his thing, that he's done all the bad things and everything? No. We are just sort of had the warm-up for what this guy could do with four more years.
Yeah, this is the thing that I don't understand, right? People forget that for at least the first couple of years, he had all kinds of good people around him, right? So when people look back
all at the best people.
All the best people. But I mean, so we passed some things legislatively, right? They got their tax cuts, they got their judges. What is happening legislatively right now? Is there an agenda? Do you see a thing that they're trying to do?
There is no agenda.
Yeah.
I get it. Nothing can get better.
Do nothing Democrats. I get it. But there is no.
Well, it's next week, Infrastructure Week.
And it's always Infrastructure Week. But so what is it? Who is going to work for him? Who's going to be his chief of staff? Who? I mean, like, you think about five more years of this. No one will work for him. But Elizabeth Warren. I mean, this is so it's interesting about Amy Klobuchar, because that is who they should. They should nominate Amy Klobuchar, or I think Pete Buttigieg. You know, after that debate, I'd sort of forgotten about Pete, even though I like him very much, because he's sort of, even though he's not a moderate, he's kind of a tonal moderate, and so he can appeal to the those of us who just want somebody who sounds like a normal person.
Yeah, which he does, yeah.
But you know, he's starting to really poll well in Iowa, and this is
Jonathan. Do you want to tell her? Or should I?
Oh, no, I'll let you.
No, I think you should.
No, you do it. No, I don't want to do it. I'm not going to say it.
Come on.
Not going to do it.
She's had a moment of happiness here.
It's because he's short, right? That's what you think? That's his Achilles heel?
He's short and very young.
He's young?
And I think this
creates a Harvard background.
It's the Harvard background.
There's an issue. Look, you can't be elected without a huge African-American vote.
Are you saying African-Americans don't like gay people?
I'm saying African-Americans.
Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying.
What about Hispanics?
The short and
Charlie,
young
are there
people?
Any other stereotypes you'd like to engage in? Look, guys, here's the thing. I'll say it for you because it's easier coming for me. It's totally true. I think the Democrats, they have an issue where whether it is that they have a female candidate, whether it's because the candidate is gay, whether it's because the candidate is black, you know, like there's always going to be some constituency of the big sort of tent that they need to pull together that maybe isn't as enthusiastic about some of the demographic makeups of that choice, which is why you end up with the two like oldest, whitest guys somehow still, you know, coming to the top, especially among African-Americans and Hispanics. That being said. I think that the moderates have time yet. I think we are stuck, and we should free ourselves from our thinking that the top three are Biden, Warren, and Sanders. I know that right now they've been holding out of this, but Sanders has now had a heart attack. Elizabeth Warren, I thought her performance was not very good. I think she has showing some of her glass jaw. I think people might start taking a second look at her. And if you look at all these top-tier candidates have real liabilities. Kamala Harris doesn't seem to have what it takes. People may start to re-look at a couple of these
younger
moderates.
Okay, so we're talking about Amy mania now, right?
I'll bet you a watch Jamie. The nominee is one of those three.
Partly,
I hope I'd lose because I'd like to buy you another watch.
But you know what? You know what, my friend, who I do the secret podcast with, so we have this conversation a lot. You also told me that Beto was rare political horse flesh and that Elizabeth Warren was dead on arrival.
She's not wearing a watch.
I don't remember.
It's on my desk. It's on my desk. He has to wind it. I have to come and wind it every day.
Thing, you know?
No. So Beto, I maintain that there is still room for shakeups in this race. I'll say it here.
Maybe. I don't. Funnily enough, I think of Buttigieg as most dangerous to Elizabeth Warren right now because he's from Indiana. He will play very, very well in Iowa. She has to win Iowa. She can't not win Iowa.
Who is this?
Warren.
I'm sorry,
Warren is do or die for Iowa.
Really?
And if she has to win both. I mean, Warren does not have a path to the presidency or a path to the nomination, rather, that does not involve her winning both Iowa and New Hampshire.
Yeah, because by the time you get to South Carolina, you're going to...
Right. She needs momentum. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if she starts underperforming early, then the bottom will fall out because there's, again, this other alternative right there who is what people actually prefer anyway. If Buttigieg were to like nose her out in Iowa, man, that would be bad for her.
And Iowa's
and
a state where he
Uncle
could play.
Joe.
So Iowa's a state where he could play. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you what, when it comes to African American voters, you know who else they don't love? Elizabeth Warren.
That's true.
So
right.
So if he rolls
and
in,
Bernie.
Yeah. Well, so this is based on the demographic breakdowns I've seen, that Bernie does the best with like millennial African Americans, and then Joe Biden with basically everybody, all African Americans over 45. But if Pete were to win Iowa, where he's got spending a lot of money, he's got a very strong operation up there. Everybody says that every event he holds is packed to the gills. So then what? He gets third in New Hampshire, hangs in South Carolina.
Yeah, at which point
there is a path for Pete.
No, but at that point, Biden is then the front runner. This is what I'm saying. Like, if that's what happens, then the nomination, yeah. Biden has won the nomination.
I'm having some PTSD flashbacks to 2015, 2016, when listening to the Rubio people talk about their 3-2-1 strategy and all that. Remember the 3-2-1
yeah.
strategy? Finished third and second and first, and
it almost
then, of
worked.
He,
actually,
he blew, he,
almost worked.
Well, you know, and then
if we're going to talk about Rubio, can we just talk about him for a minute?
Oh, because, could we please?
Because Marco Rubio, is there a greater disappointment?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, that's true. That's right. That's true.
Yes.
You're a tremendous disappointment to me.
But let me. So this is the thing about Rubio. So he goes out for Trump goes out on the lawn, White House lawn, and says, China, please investigate Joe and Hunter Biden. Right. And what is Marco Rubio says? He's joking, guys. He is just trying to gig you, and you're so sensitive, you media types.
That's what the Syria pullout was, too. It was just a joke.
Also hilarious. And then, of course, Trump turns around, and I tweeted at the time, don't worry, like, soon enough, Trump is going to say he's 100% serious and leave these guys twisting in the wind, which, of course, he does. He does very soon. So then, what does Marco Rubio do? Because he's from Florida. He says, oh, the Doral would be excellent as a Floridian. I love that. It brings so much joy. So he goes to bat for him on the Doral, and then once again, Trump pulls back from it. Does Marco Rubio want to ever stop being humiliated by Donald Trump? Or does he just want to be humiliated endlessly?
Maybe it becomes habit for me.
I got to say, I used to look at the way the Jeb people hated Rubio. And I didn't understand it. And it's because, of course, I didn't know the full Rubio. Like, you have to be up close with him to understand. Now I kind of get the way that the Jeb people hate him more than they do any other Republican, including Donald Trump.
I don't know who it was, because I think I've actually quoted him.
I don't mean Jeb, in case you were listening, Governor Jeb. Bush. I don't mean you yourself. I mean your people.
Well, I don't remember who said it, but there's something about the people who were beaten by Trump during that primary. It's like they never recovered. It's like they not only lost to Trump, he tore their spines out.
Except for Jeb.
With the exception of Jeb, but I mean, you look at Ted Cruz, you look at Marco Rubio, and look at Lindsey Graham, who, by the way, is last report he's back supporting the withdrawal from Syria now. The guy has just nothing left.
Is that true?
I don't know.
He's supporting it
sooner or later,
because he was.
Because I'll eventually be right.
He was kind of doing this thing over the weekend where it was, Mr. President, if you're listening.
I am your worst nightmare. Yeah, trust me, I don't think that you are anyone's worst nightmare, Lindsey Graham.
No, I think you're right about the fact that there was something he broke them in some way.
Yeah,
where
broke them, yeah.
It's like just they no longer care about their self-respect. It's like Ted Cruz wrote that like weird obsequious piece shortly after Donald Trump was elected. I can't remember for what, but it was like for the Time 100 or something like that. Ted Cruz wrote it.
Yeah.
And it was after, he said his dad murdered JFK and his wife was, I mean, like, if I am all for if you have a political rivalry in a primary, you all come together. Like, I think that's great. This is a whole different level and totally unbecoming. And I guess they just now they see their powers being derived from him directly.
I don't have any other explanation for that. But
to bring it full circle, what is his name? Pierre Delecto?
Pierre Delecto.
Yeah. One of the tweets that he liked was this picture of Marco Rubio in a very large chair, which makes Marco Rubio look comically tiny. And
little, you mean? It makes him look little.
It makes him look like a little Marco. And then there's like the tweet is, never has a picture so summed up the essence of Marco Rubio. And that was one of the things. That was one of the things that Pierre liked on Twitter.
What was the last famous pseudonym? Danger.
Carlos Danger.
Carlos Danger.
Carlos Danger.
Yeah.
Okay, but we won't go there because that's very different.
And what was Trump's play name when he was calling something Barron?
Yeah, John Barron.
John Barron. Yeah.
You know what? No, again, speaking of a story that would end the career of anyone else, and that's like 106, right? The fact that he would call people up and pretend to be somebody he didn't. You know,
you guys remember that that video with Trump killing all those people?
Oh, yeah.
The media. That was 1 week ago today.
I know.
It feels like it was, what, 3 months ago?
This is something that we have to constantly remind ourselves of, is when we think that this event will have these effects. He could be impeached by Thanksgiving, and by April, we'll be sitting around going, do you remember when the president was impeached? Did you remember that? Or do you remember when the president was going to invite the Taliban to celebrate the anniversary of 9/11?
Who even remembers the Taliban?
Exactly. So this is part of the problem, is that we're all going to be, at some point, Marco Rubio, we will all be broken. We will all be broken. It's just like, humiliate us.
Now, John Bolton.
Well, John Bolton.
This is a real question. Are people going to come after Trump for the past? Are there any? Because you don't need everybody to have self-respect. You need a very, very small number of people to sort of crack the mirror. And
okay, but you know who can do it, though? These four-star generals and these admirals, these are the
McRaven, right?
McRaven. You have John Allen was out there, and he's already broken with him in the past. You have these are the folks that in Trump world are very hard to discredit. I mean, he may try, but you're starting to see some pretty serious guys. I thought it was going to take a James Mattis to do it, but if Mattis is not going to step forward, these other guys are going to. And if Mattis ever does, and you really have something, that's a danger to him. That's a flank that I'm not sure that he's prepared to handle.
I totally agree with that. And I also think that, you know, I spend a lot of time certainly complaining about Republican silence or the silence of anybody who could stand up and make a difference. But it would not shock me at all if the closer we get to either impeachment and then ultimately to the election, the more people you see coming out and saying, you know, enough is enough. Here's what I've seen. Here's why it's not okay. Although I got to tell you, I am sort of befuddled by Mattis. And his first public appearance was sort of at some dinner where he was telling some jokes.
That was the Al Smith dinner.
Yeah.
It was a roast.
It was a roast. It was hilarious.
Oh, but I doesn't it seem, okay, I get it, that's a joke, that's a night for jokes.
Yes.
Doesn't it seem like maybe things are serious enough that if Mattis is going to go out there and joke about that maybe at on a serious show or in a serious newspaper, he says, actually, things are really scary, and let me tell you about what I saw while I was in there.
Baby steps, baby steps.
Chuckles.
Here. I thought the fact that he used the bone spur line, I thought that was a tell for me that he's warming up to it.
I right? hope so.
Well, we all hope so. And again, thanks for coming in where we all work.
Great to see you in the studio, Charlie.
It is great to be in our high-level studio here, which we should have more pictures of. We should put more pictures so people see what the Bulwark studio looks like.
It's magnificent.
It is magnificent. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.